These are the PCORI methodology standards. This category is about standards associated with patient-centeredness. It was prepared by and will be presented by Dr. Albert Wu from the Department of Health Policy and Management and Dr. Clifton Bingham from the Department of Medicine.
Hello, this is Clifton Bingham. In this module, I will be discussing PC2, which covers ensuring the representativeness of the study population, recruitment, and retention. The objectives of this module are to describe why the inclusion of representative participants, including those from populations of special interest, is an important component of PCOR, to describe strategies and processes that will ensure the representativeness of study populations, the limitation of bias, and the generalizability of findings. And finally, to prepare a plan to identify, select, recruit, and retain study participants that will improve the generalizability of study results. PC2 is to identify, select, recruit, and retain study participants representative of the spectrum of the population of interest and ensure that data are collected thoroughly and systematically from all study participants. PC2 also states that research proposals and subsequent study reports should describe the plan to ensure representativeness of participants, how participants are identified, selected, recruited, enrolled, and retained in the study to reduce or address the potential impact of selection bias. 3, efforts employed to maximize adherence to agreed-on enrollment practices. And 4, the methods used to ensure unbiased and systematic data collection from all participants. The standard also states that if the population of interest includes people who are more difficult to identify, recruit, and/or retain than other study participants, for example, individuals historically underrepresented in healthcare research, such as those with multiple disease conditions, low literacy, low socioeconomic status, or poor healthcare access, as well as racial and ethnic minority groups and people living in rural areas, then specific plans to address population-unique issues for participant identification, recruitment, and retention are needed. The standard speaks to representativeness of the study population. And the question arises, why is representativeness important? For the results of comparative effectiveness research studies to have the broadest impact and applicability, it's important that the population studied is as inclusive as possible as the real world of patients. Will the results only be applicable to a small group of individuals with certain characteristics, or will the conclusions be generalizable to a larger population? In order to ensure representativeness, it's important to minimize selection bias. When thinking about a study design, it's important to consider which groups need to be included. Are there considerations within a particular disease or condition that need to be considered, such as the level of disease activity or prior treatment? Are there other considerations within a population that may be important, such as an internet-based sample versus a clinic sample? Are there groups that are being missed that may be important, especially noting those with multiple conditions, low literacy and socioeconomic status, poor access, racial and ethnic minorities, rural individuals, etc. It's also important to ensure that the outcomes of interest have been validated in the population under study. When thinking about each of the different groups that may need to be included or considered, stakeholder input can be very helpful in identifying these groups. When designing a study, it's important to think about how the sample of individuals who will be included in the study are representative of those included in the overall target population. In this diagram, I've shown a target population as being the larger outer circle. You can see that the smaller circle of patients here labeled as the accessible population may not represent all of the characteristics in the target population. And then within the accessible population, those who are selected to participate in a study are further limited in terms of their disease characteristics. So the smaller study samples reflect some aspects of the larger disease under study, but may not be fully inclusive. You see, for instance, here that in the accessible population, you're leaving out patients with this lighter color representation of some disease characteristic. I will use an example from one of our studies to demonstrate these concepts. The treatment condition for us under interest were those patients who have rheumatoid arthritis. Our study was related to the collection of patient-reported outcomes collected at the same time as a clinic visit within an electronic health record. And our study sample represented patients' characteristics that we were concerned about, including levels of disease activity from low, moderate, and high. Across these different strata, we were able to sample adequately from the target population. But you can imagine another sampling strategy that we might need that would include patients with various levels of disease duration, from very early disease to very established disease. Now imagine if the very light color at the top of the circle would represent those with very early disease duration. You can see that our sampling strategy would not adequately cover these patients. Thus, there may be some bias introduced to the study for failure to include a sufficiently representative patient population. Once we've thought about and considered issues related to the representativeness of the final study sample, it's important to carefully think through how those patients will specifically be recruited to join the study and what efforts may be necessary to retain those patients throughout the duration of the study. Recruitment and retention are key aspects for all studies, and recruitment strategies and retention strategies do need to be carefully thought through. A realistic plan is needed that will allow enough patients to conduct the final analysis. When thinking through recruitment and retention, we've already talked about who needs to be included in the study. And then it's important to think about how to facilitate their recruitment, to maximize their retention, to think about what potential barriers they may be, and also to think about any additional or special considerations for a particular patient population. This is another area where patients and stakeholders can help to think through these larger questions. The methods of research patient recruitment are broad and diverse, and vary widely depending on a particular study type and the population of interest. Here I show several of the different methods that can be used to recruit patients that extend from the use of databases, mailings, letters and referrals to other providers, flyers, posters and brochures, and postings in clinics, and newspaper and radio and potentially television advertisements or health fairs. I would classify these as being the more traditional methods of patient recruitment for studies. However, as we move forward, the importance of using other means of identifying patients for inclusion in studies becomes more and more important. This would include utilizing stakeholder groups such as advocacy groups and patient communities, thinking about how to use tools such as social media with Facebook and Twitter, websites such as Craigslist, and optimization strategies within Google searches. And finally, to think about how PCORI resources, such as the Clinical Data Research Networks and the Patient-Powered Research Networks, could be used to advertise or potentially to recruit patients for inclusion in a study. As noted here, one size definitely does not fit all, and a diversity of approaches may provide the highest yield. A number of strategies have been suggested as ways of developing a recruitment plan. Many have noted that thinking about a brand for a study may be important in terms of giving a logo or a name to that study from its beginning. Other considerations, beyond the participants themselves, is whether or not caregivers, for instance, might need to be approached to recruit the participants in the study in the cases of parents for children or a caregiver for one with Alzheimer's. It's very reasonable to think about what has worked before, not only for your own group, but also for others who are doing similar types of research to identify what are best practices, and to think through the challenges and facilitators and solutions to those that might be available. I note here that it may be very helpful to take advantage of that which you know, your existing cohorts and patient populations, because these might represent the low-hanging fruit that you would have the least difficulty recruiting for a particular study. It's extremely important to evaluate the recruitment throughout the study. Does the population have the appropriate individuals or adjustments needed so that the final population will be sufficiently targeting those groups that need to be included? Another suggestion for using patients and stakeholders is to ask where they would seek information about clinical studies to participate in. This could provide valuable information about which of the strategies might be most appropriate and successful for your particular study. There are a number of potential barriers to recruitment. These can be on the subject-related side, things that participants might complain of, such as scheduling, time, or other commitments. Uncertainties or risks involved in potentially therapeutic interventional studies, and issues related to language and culture. Investigator-related causes include personnel and staffing, IRB issues, the complexities of multi-center studies. There may also be protocol-related barriers to recruitment, such as unreasonable inclusion and exclusion criteria, or the numbers of procedures or visits that are being required that make the protocol unfeasible. And there may be other outside influences, such as beliefs or attitudes or other structural or system changes that could represent a barrier to recruitment. When developing a recruitment and retention plan, I like to think of this in terms of a funnel, the leaks, and the necessary final yield. The funnel represents identification, pre-screening, screening, with the result of those patients entering the study or those that are randomized. Along the way, there can be dropouts for a number of reasons, including lack of efficacy, adverse events, moving away, changes in life circumstances or time availability, intercurrent illness and death, to name a few. But ultimately, at the end, you need a sufficient number of completers that will be available for your final data analysis. Indeed, it's this completer group upon which sample size and power calculations are based. When thinking about developing your recruitment and retention strategies, it's important to go through the mathematics of what you need in the final population and what you need to start to get there. I think an easy approach is to think about the leaks. How many patients do you need in the final analysis for your sample size calculation? For this example, let's say 175. And then you need to estimate how many patients might drop out along the way, say 30%. So 70% of those who start would remain at the end. So how many patients then do you need to enroll in the study? And that would be 250. Now, getting people enrolling in the study and screening patients are different as well. So how many patients do you need to recruit to achieve your enrollment goal? What is the final sample needed? 250 from above. And then what is the anticipated yield going to be from your pre-screening and screening strategy? Let's say that 50% of those who are screened will qualify. And then how many screening visits would be required? This would be 250 divided by 0.5, and that would come up to 500. So now you have 500 patients that would need to be screened to achieve a final completer sample of 175. It's important to set up timelines for recruitment, and these should be based on the time available for patients to be recruited, for instance, 12 months. So if we have 500 patients that need to be screened over 12 months, this would be 42 screening visits per month, amounting to 21 enrollments per month at the end. A number of methods have been used to improve research subject retention. One of these is to follow progress in real time and conduct a planned interim analysis or analyses to evaluate why patients might be dropping out and whether or not modifications can be made to the study in order to improve retention. It's very important to maintain communication with research participants, be available for phone calls, emails, etc., with questions as they arise. We found that sending reminders of visits and check-in calls can also improve retention. Newsletters of study progress and other educational materials about a condition under study, for instance, are often seen as being very useful to participants in the study and keeping them involved. Thank you cards, acknowledgement cards, such as birthday cards, and other small appreciation tokens have also been successful in retaining patients in studies. And finally, considerations of things like transportation and parking coverage can also go a long way for many research participants. This is another place where patients and stakeholders can provide valuable suggestions about what they might think would help them to stay in a particular study. And finally, a few other considerations in recruitment and retention. Human subjects and IRB approvals are needed for recruitment materials and strategies. What you propose in your study may need to be modified based on their recommendations. It's important to account for the time needed to move through the IRB process, especially in studies that might have multiple sites, each with an individual IRB, and its own concerns about recruitment materials. It's very important to account for any costs and budget for these for recruitment and retention strategies, both in terms of the personnel time as well as any other financial resources needed, for instance, for developing brochures or for tokens of appreciation. As noted before, ongoing and real-time assessment of recruiting goals and retention estimates are critical to follow and permit restructuring and adjustment of strategies. Developing a recruitment and research strategy are all important in decreasing potential selection bias in a study. It's important at the beginning and at the end of the study to determine if there are characteristics of the enrolled patients that are different from the general population or the target population. These would include things as discussed before, like socio-demographic factors, disease-related factors, or other factors. Specific strategies are needed to minimize potential bias. And finally, if there is any potential bias, how might this be accounted for in the final analysis? An example from one of our studies used a clinic-based sample as well as an internet-based sample of people completing patient-reported outcome measures. We had a question of whether or not there were differences between these two groups. We had developed a screening questionnaire for the internet-based sample to ensure that the participants had the disease of interest, but we didn't have any correlative clinical data. We tested the same screening questionnaire in our clinic patients to validate and determine what types of patients might have been excluded from the internet-based sample and whether these exclusions would have affected the final results. This is an example of identifying potential bias in our study and developing methods that would help us to determine whether or not this bias would affect the final results.